The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Great Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. The final test of this Ashes series is upon us, but before then, we're going to be wrapping up the Melbourne Test match. Everything that happened there, Alistair Cook is still batting along with Steve Smith. Mitch Marsh scored the slowest 30 you'll ever see. Is he now Bradman and God combined? Then, of course, the Sydney Test match, which starts tomorrow or today as you're listening to it. Mason Crane is set to play. Smith possibly not playing. Mitchell Starc is playing. And we're going to divulge everything involving the Sydney Test match for the Australians to win 4-0. Then there's a big bash, of course. The Australian ODI squad is announced. Jared Kimber is on the show. Hashtag AskTGC. Another wonderful show for you. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined, as ever, by Sam Perry and our good friend David Edwards. Welcome, boys.
Hello, Ian.
G'day, you guys.
All right. What day is it?
Yeah.
Does anyone know what day it is?
Doesn't everyone just feel like just a Tim Bresnan heavy ball? Doesn't everyone just feel a little bit heavy this time of year? No one knows what day it is. Everyone's drunk all the fucking beers in the world and everyone's just heavy.
I do feel a bit heavy around the middle section, he goes. And you can't notice it on Skype, but I'm certainly feeling a few kgs overweight at the moment off the back of a big Christmas. But off the back of a big test match, eh, boys? Or was it poor?
Well, very good, Eddos. Let's start in Melbourne. We'll wrap up the Boxing Day test. Last time we spoke, it was midway through the Boxing Day test. Dave, you were unavailable to join us. Pez, how did you enjoy Melbourne? Was it the worst test match you've ever seen? A dead pitch in a dead rubber test match and we got a draw.
Yeah, I tried to get into it. I think when we spoke last week, we just essentially created parallels between it and a third grade match at test level. It was just, I think even Lehman said it was just stump to stump reverse swing bowling. And you know, the major conversation was just between kind of amateur horticulturalists talking about drop-in technology wickets. You know, everyone knows that nobody knows anything about pitches, but we all pretend we do anyway. And then I suppose we got into the ball tampering stuff, where I think that's pretty much the same as well, isn't it? We all pretend we know how reverse swing works and the science behind that. Nobody knows anything. No one knows what Anderson was doing with the flaps. He probably was doing something, you know. But cricketers like that. Like I say that as a term of endearment to Anderson. You know, they probably already have their excuses ready. He's forged a career off making the ball talk. Good luck to him.
So, Dave, we didn't get a chance to speak to you last week, but what were your thoughts on the Melbourne Test match? How much did you enjoy that dead rubber?
Oh, mate, it was the worst dead rubber I've ever seen. And the ICC has rightly just gone to the MCG. Mate, that's poor. You are poor. And that's a very grade cricket type criticism. Not one I expected from an international sporting federation. But I do agree with the rating that the ICC has handed down for the pitch, that it was fucking yuck, or poor, as they put it. It just took me one over to realise that the pitch was rubbish. I'm sure you guys were the same, you know, when I flicked on and I just saw that first over. And it didn't matter how many times Shane Warne was banging on about the Boxing Day test being the best thing ever, you know, the centrepiece of Australia's sporting calendar and the huge crowds it attracts. I wasn't sucked in by any of that nonsense, because it was a fucking poor pitch. No moisture, boring and yuck. No pace, no spin, no carry. It wasn't like a, you know, some scary Caribbean pitch with like cracks down the middle poor. It was just fucking yuck poor. Just not good. Nothing. Not conducive to test cricket. And those involved should hang their heads in shame and walk away from cricket forever.
The thing about the MCG wicket is that like it's always like that.
Yeah,
it really has. It's been like that for a really long time. I was just really happy to hear people start to say it for once, because it's a bit sort of sacrilegious to even say anything bad about anything related to Melbourne sport. It's just a poor wicket, and it has been for a long time.
Well, I mean, let's get to the issue of the entire pitches around the country. So I think Adelaide is really the only one that's dished it up a decent wicket with grass on it. Obviously, it helps that it's under lights as well, pink ball, so it swings a bit. Brisbane was shit. But it was a terrible wicket, Brisbane, for the first, like, 3 days. Wacker, fucking Mitchell Marsh got 180 and Steve Smith's still batting from the Wacker. He probably walked home. That was dull. Melbourne, shocking. Like, we've had some, like we complain, we being the, like, Australians complain about when we go to India, oh, their wickets over there are shit, aren't they? Well, fuck me. There's wickets here are shocking. Like, they're just producing, like, just awful cricket, aren't they? Like, okay, yeah, bounces a bit at the Wacker, but fuck me, it's flat. Like, it's just no contest. This is why cricket in England is just way better. It swings for a start. The Duke's ball is a way better ball than the cricket ball, and the Kookaburra, rather. Because it's just an even contest between bat and ball.
Why is the Duke's ball talk so much?
I don't.
Why does it talk? Gonna,
I could make
No, just make something up, though, because that's what you've got to do.
He goes,
situation.
You're on a roll, just run with it. Why is it talk?
Why it's different is because of the overcast conditions, and it's a different lacquer. And I just want to say lacquer.
The lacquer.
That's
sounds like the whacker.
Yeah, rhymes with whacker, yeah. I don't know why. I think the seam's bigger. I'm pretty sure the Duke's ball is the bigger seam. I think that is a fact.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at least it's a contest. I don't know what we're expecting for the Sydney Test match, but, I mean, Ashton Agar's been brought into the squad. He won't play. But are we still... Like, Australians still get really stuck with, like, what wickets were like in the 90s and the 80s. Like, the Wacker's the fastest pitch in the country. Well, it's not. Sydney always spins because Stuart McGill always played. Well... They're not going to play two spinners, and it's probably not going to turn that much. So what are you guys expecting? Let's just talk about the pitch for a second, because it is a first time the debutante test for the groundsman of the SCG's name. His name escapes me, but it is his first time having a test match at the SCG's. I mean, are we expecting anything different, any level of excitement?
Yeah, I mean the SCG test really is like it's a sleepy New Year's test. For those who haven't been, you turn up, you look at the members stand, it's full of basically people in various hues of blue Ralph Lauren polo shirts and boat shoe combinations. Some of them wear their Greg Chappell hat from their rep cricket career in under 13s, and you wonder about what they've done with their lives. You wonder if you should go and say hello, you're not quite so sure. You see other people from grade cricket there who are pretty much wearing the same stuff, except they've got like maybe a rugby jersey wrapped around their neck. And to the cricket itself.
God.
Someone from New South Wales scores 100 somewhere along the line. There's always a fresh face, you know, not so much a debutant. There's always someone includes a new spinner somewhere that will sort of unceremoniously, vulgarly, you know, where we'll vulgarly unpick their technique while some... you know, reruns of Shane Warne taking wickets against, you know, Chander Paul and Callis is happening. So, I mean, that's pretty much how the SCG test works, right?
Yeah, well, you've nailed it. I mean, but I think the Sydney public deserve better than that, Pez. I mean, because as we all know, Sydney grade cricket is the highest form of amateur cricket in the world, bar none. It's called Sydney Test Cricket for a reason, and we deserve better than dead rubber fucking tests. I just want once in my life to go to a test match that means something. I mean, you talked through, you know, what it's like to go to the SCG test, and it is good to walk around and see fellow ex-grade cricketers and get your hand absolutely massacred by some of the strongest handshakes imaginable, which is all just a massive alpha power play, and just to stand in the members section, drink those craft beers and feel good about yourself even though you're failing in life, because it's all we've ever known, we have deep-seated fear of change. But it all means nothing, lads.
So,
does anything mean anything?
No, nothing means anything.
Serious question.
Yeah, I mean, you've really nailed it, Dave, like, truthfully. And, I mean, we've spoken... Listeners of this podcast will know that we've been speaking all podcast series about how much we just wanted either the fourth or the fifth test match just to be a live rubber, which is definitely not a real term, but, you know, we just wanted a live test match. And basically what we're going to get is... We're going to get Mason Graham playing his first test match. We're going to get Tom Curran playing his second test match. Ali's going to play, and he's hardly bowled the ball in the last three tests. And Anderson and Broad are going to bowl 600 overs each. It's fucking... This is the worst case scenario for this test series. I thought... I mean, a lot of people expected it to be close because, you know, neither team is particularly strong. But this is just like... We're playing against, you know, poor old, like, Mason Crane. Like, he's a genuinely good spinner in his own right. But, like, he's basically going to have a debut test... And he's going to be bowling against the 2017 Bradman. How is this going to go?
No idea here, guys. There's a reason why this is not the official CA podcast, because we are just slamming everything about this series and absolutely talking it down. But it is just going to be fucking depressing. I mean, there was so much hype in the lead up to this series. And yeah, well, it's not going to be 6-0 like we want, but it's going to be 4-1.
So Pez... You, as the leg spinner of this podcast, do you want to talk us through Mason Crane?
I'm very much looking forward to seeing Mason Crane play. I'm also not looking forward to how, unceremoniously scrutinised he will be by smug Australians who are, you know, ahead in the series 3-0 and want to talk about leg spin bowling, even though they, none of us know anything about it, really. I mean, this is a guy that's, Mason Crane's a guy that's, 20 years old, is about to debut for his country, attempting and the most trying and difficult of arts of all. He's played for New South Wales, he's taken a fifer. That won't be enough. He'll come on to bowl, Smith and Warner will run at him. It'll be difficult for him, he'll have men on the boundary. People will sit at home and say, well, he's got to have a bloke under the lid. Warne had a bloke under the lid. And just at that point, they'll start showing footage, like I said, of Chanderpaul and Callis and, his and the Bassett Alley ball, and Warne will talk through it. And then they'll just flick back to Crane, maybe just a bit short outside off stump, and we'll just go, oh, geez, he's terrible, this bloke, isn't he? And that's pretty much what happens at the SCG. Some unfamiliar face bowls, and we all pretend we know what we're talking about. And I don't feel sorry for him. I think he'll be excited because, but really, like, you couldn't. It'd be pretty hard to ask for like a more difficult debut. You're basically 3-0 down. You're bowling leg spin in Australia, which is just so unforgiving a place to do it against Australians as an Englishman. I'm wishing him well.
So. Last time England were here 4 years ago, Scott Borthwick played the corresponding fixture, and he is now barely bowling in county cricket. He's now playing as like a batsman in county cricket, and also at the time he was barely bowling in grade cricket here in Sydney. But Mason Crane, to be fair to him, is a legitimately good bowler, and he had a wonderful series or year when he was playing out. He actually played at my old club at Gordon, ends up in the New South Wales team, because hence was such was his form that he warranted selection. But can we just say, like, it would have been such a coup for us, had he actually replied to my WhatsApp message I sent to him to get him on the podcast, like I tried to. And the fact that he saw that message and just never got back to me. He got my text. He got the text. He got the text. I know you got the text, Mason. Yeah. And we wanted you on the show. Pez, you spoke to the comms manager of the England cricket team. He said, yeah, we'll get him on. We'll get Mason on. This was like back in the first test. And they never replied. So I don't know what I'm saying. Fuck Mason.
Well, you're lifting the lid on our methods for attracting talent on this podcast, which is just nice, just little keen insight and breaking down the fourth wall.
WhatsApp. I mean, you guys are heading out to the SCG, though, aren't you? Maybe you can speak to Danny from the English Cricket Communications. To be fair to Danny, he did have a small issue with Johnny Bairstow and Ben Stokes while we were asking if Mason Crane would come onto the Great Cricketer podcast. He may have prioritised other work. Not for me to judge what he should have done there, but maybe we'll have a chance to talk to Mason afterwards, or maybe we should just take the hint that he doesn't want to talk to us.
Yeah, he read the message, blue ticks. That's all I'm saying, Pez, two blue ticks. All right, let's move on to the Big Bash. I don't know how much you guys have digested the Big Bash, but one of the most interesting stories that have come out of the past 24 hours is Matthew Wade gave Joss Butler a massive send-off, and it made me think, Matt Wade, like, what's he up to now? It was good to see him, wasn't it?
So pretty much the same day that Tim Payne was selected in the ODI side as well. Yeah. And you just see this footage of Wade just screaming in Joss Butler's face and you think, oh, Matthew.
He was selected on that. That was like really represented good a point. Dark selection criteria, a little dark 24-month period when we selected Matthew Wade based on his chirp. And now we've gone Tim Payne, not only results, good at keeping, wonderful salad, good guy.
Here's
everything.
What I thought
full
about
full package.
That whole run out situation was like, okay, he like threw the stumps down. He basically won the game for his team, the Hurricanes. Like, so it was a bloody nice bit of skill, and he was excited. And I think he's like well in within his rights to celebrate. But it was just that, like, it wasn't even so much that he yelled in his face. It's like he ran in Butler's direction to yell in his face. He went out of his way to yell in his face. Such was his excitement. And I thought, no, that's just, good on Tim Payne being selected.
Where does excitement cross into, like, vilifying your opposition? Like, there's some wires crossed in there just from playing cricket for so long. That's like, I need to celebrate this wonderful thing that I've done, but the only way I can do that and to kind of let that out is through just getting in someone's face, getting in their grill.
Well, I mean, that is Australian cricket, isn't it? I mean, celebration and vilification is just one and the same now. They just mean the same. They essentially mean the same things. The way you celebrate is through vilification. And I can see why Matt Wade, on the day that he was sort of dropped from the ODI side, decided to double down on his great strength, which is chirping. Except instead of chirping, he just yelled in someone's face, you know. Essentially what he was saying was like, Steve, are you watching?
Yeah.
You know, are you watching me, Steve?
Yeah. You know how the Australian team song, like you would have seen the footage of it when Australia whitewashed England last time, the SCG, and they huddled around the pitch, and the chorus, if you will, it's not a chorus, but the last bit of the song is Australia, you fucking beauty, and like just the aggressive nature, like, because the fucking bit doesn't even fit into the rhyme, but they speed up the Australia you to get in the fucking, and like and then the Channel 9 commentators are just like the camera crew and the sound guys are like right there in the huddle, and then they have to like pretends like we haven't all just heard them say Australia, you fucking beauty on just like, you know, daytime television. It's just like, it's just such a good Australian song because it's so aggressive and I love it.
I can't watch that song properly anymore because I just reminded of Dave wanting that song to be Champion by Grinspoon. I just want them to be huddled around the pitch just singing, so you want to be a champion. Maybe Phil Jamison in the middle.
So much better.
Each to their own.
All right, just last thing before we get Jared Kimber on the line. The Australian ODI squad has been announced, and the biggest omission is that Glenn Maxwell has not been picked. And Steve Smith, in his press conference today, said that Glenn needs to train a little bit smarter. What does that mean?
Well, it makes you wonder how he trains. Like, I can only assume that when Lehman calls out last six, he's not blocking out the over to preserve his wicket. He's definitely the bloke who bombs his last 150 metres, high fives 10 blokes on the way out, and runs to his car and just leaves. That's how I train. I assume that's how Glenn trains.
I mean, I've noted Smith's comments saying we've all seen the way he can come out and play and do all his funky stuff and be pretty cool with that. I mean, if that's not just a direct reference to Maxwell promoting that Ashes video game and taking off Smith's batting with that whole robot suit on and stuff, then I don't know what is. This is clearly a reaction to what Maxwell did there.
Some of the words you just used there, Pez, really kind of veered into crazy, crazier, Mo Matthews territory in terms of the characters connotated with craziness. Is Maxwell falling into that category now?
I don't know. I mean, I think like as much as Steve Smith's the next Bradman, and you just can't say anything bad about him. Like he's just shown like a little bit of a conservative streak every so often, doesn't he, Steve Smith? Like Glenn Maxwell, I think he's just heading into that. Like he's wanted to railroad him into rare unit territory. I know there's been a little bit of conjecture over the fact that John Holland hasn't been picked as well, and you know Steve O'Keefe got the gig over John Holland even though he was essentially suspended in the middle of the year. Like Smith has the people that he likes in the side. I'm just wondering whether Maxwell is not one of those people.
Well, it's natural to become more and more conservative as you take on leadership roles, and so I assume that's just the evolution of Steve Smith as a person. Maybe politically he's becoming more conservative as well. We all kind of venture towards the centre as we get older, so perhaps that's flowing through into his captaincy.
Isn't like don't you guys get the impression though that like Steve Smith is actually like at his core he's just a really like quiet individual who doesn't really like the attention, and but he has this role like this figurehead leader of like this oppressive regime, i.e. the Australian cricket team, and so he has to like, you know, assert these things which aren't natural to him. Like he has to be alpha, you know, as like the linchpin of the side. He has to be the alpha dog, and it just some of these things seem unnatural to me.
Yeah, he's definitely an unnatural alpha, Steve Smith. Like he's an unnatural Gen Y alpha, but an alpha nonetheless. An alpha nonetheless, I'd say.
Alan and Unwin really missed a trick when they didn't title his autobiography that, the unnatural alpha.
Well, if there's nothing else, gentlemen, we should get Jared Kimber on the line.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
Okay, lads, I'm very, very excited about this one. The person who's on the line, he's in Coogee at the moment, has one of the broadest, craziest, fun bodies of writing work in world cricket. He's currently with ESPN Crick Infos, their global writer. He's done things like the Chuck Fleetwood Smith's video series, On the Road. He's done Polite Inquiries and Two Men Out with Andy Zaltzman. He co-directed and co-wrote the documentary film Death of a Gentleman that got theatrical release throughout the cricket world and now plays on Netflix. It's won awards everywhere. He was nominated for Best New Writer in the National Sport Club Book Awards for 2010. That never happened to us. He wrote an Ashes book called When Freddie Became Jesus. He's written five other books before his latest release, which we're going to talk about. And according to some corners of the internet, and he can confirm this or deny this, he also provided the cover photo for P. Diddy's album The Last Train to Paris. He's done some stuff with ABC Grandstand. We're going to talk about that as well. Been published in Wisden, The Telegraph. He's also a member of that wandering team, The Authors 11. This should be pretty funny because I'm of course talking about Jared Kimber. Jared, welcome to The Great Cricketer.
Of course I did Puff Daddy's album cover. I don't know why you asked the question. Why did you question that of all the nonsense that you just said?
I don't know that, like, yeah, I mean, I guess I grew up with kids' TV programs where you had to sort of call, you know, find what the odd one out was. That just seemed to me to be the one that didn't really quite fit in. Like, when I first read that, I thought Kimber's just got onto Wikipedia here and just added in his contribution to P. Diddy's Last Train to Paris album. But no, that you took that photo?
Yeah, I mean, you know, of all the albums I would claim, I mean, if I was going to claim one of his albums, I think it'd be the Godzilla one he produced because it's Godzilla and that's cooler. I think more people know about the fact that I provided the album cover than they actually have ever listened to that album.
Well, I mean, I did do some work on it.
I'm not familiar with that track.
Because you're not listed as Jared Kimber, you're listed as J-Rod on it. I presume that's your rap name?
Yeah. Yeah, I when I'm dropping it, like it's hot and those sorts of things, you don't need the extra letters, really. You know, you want to get down and dirty with the kids, like rappers do. Like 50-year-old rappers like P. Daddy do.
P. Daddy. we haven't normally started our interviews that way. I don't think we've started talking about rap to anybody, including Brenda Julian, Jared. But, I mean, let's bring it back to club cricket. You know, can you just tell us what your relationship to club cricket is, you know, what it means to you?
I was taken to a cricket club when I was about, it depends on the story, but a week and a half, 2.5 weeks old. And so for me, club cricket was normal life. It didn't occur to me until I was about 19 or 20 that everyone else wasn't doing some form of sport, let alone cricket itself,
right,
all the time. So for me, it was the thing that you did, that everyone did. And anyone not doing it had this, you know, hole in their heart. Now I realize they were all living really good lives and we were, you know, screwing around, getting angry for no reason.
Tell us about Death of a Gentleman. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will probably have heard of the movie. A lot of them may have seen it as well. When we left that film, two things stuck with me. One was that amazing scene where Ed Cowan was talking really openly about how, you know, his view was that people didn't think he was good enough to play for Australia just after he got out in the 2015 Ashes. 2013, sorry. And then India, Australia and England were hoovering up all the money in world cricket. I mean, what's the state of play now?
They're still kind of doing it. They're just doing it a bit more on the down low now. It's not as bad as it was in the bad old days. And unfortunately, what needed to happen at that time, we're at a special moment in cricket history there where all the other small, a little while, got together and said, yeah, we're going to do something really good. And then they went, oh, but what if we go to Division Two? Or, you know, what if we don't get to play India all the time? And so they went back to just saving their own backs again. So cricket's in similar place that it's been basically since the rise of India, which is dependent on India and, you know, waiting to see what happens with court cases and things like that, and the BCCI. So no one's really sure. So it's not a great time for cricket. But there are potential things that could be done and that will be ruined by cricket boards, you know, in the next few months, I'm assuming.
So, Jared, you've obviously got a long, well, your whole life has basically been involved in cricket, and when we'll touch on your novella in a moment's time as well. But just with the, you know, the administration stuff, I mean, how much of a disconnect is there between the money that's being taken in by cricket administrators and what actually goes into grassroots cricket?
It probably depends on different countries. I think countries like Australia are quite open at the moment, and maybe New Zealand is another one that's quite open, and Cricket Island. But we don't really, we actually don't know how much money the BCCI, for instance, have. We don't know how much money the Sri Lankan Cricket Board have most of the time. Sri Lankan Cricket Board opens a new test venue every 15 minutes, but is perpetually broke. So the government's obviously giving them money for some things, but not for anything else. So we don't know. But we were told while we were making the film that the BCCI was sitting on eight billion dollars American, which is pretty good. You could do some stuff with that. They still don't seem to have grown the game nationwide. For instance, there's a huge part of that sort of northeastern part of India that don't seem to have any cricket facilities, or I'm pretty sure even a first class team. It's not open, and it's not done particularly well. And realistically, you know, if there was a strong governing body, if the ICC was actually a governing body rather than the body who provides the balls and the umpires, we'd have to learn these sorts of things. But instead, it just sort of goes. We don't know exactly 100% where the money goes. And look, you even see it with the, you know, with the Cricket Australia stuff about the grassroots when the strike was going on. No one could really say what they were saying was true or not. It's funny though, since the strike's finished, no one's talking about no one from Cricket Australia is talking about the grassroots effect of all the players getting paid all that money. But anyway, I digress.
Jared, we go from talking about, you know, billions and billions of dollars in revenue to the next discussion, which will be about ABC Grandstand, a much smaller organisation, but still quite relevant in today's, in terms of the cricketing audience in Australia. And you wrote a pretty good article, I thought, this week, based on your own experiences with the organisation. You kind of painted the picture of there not really being anyone in charge. You were kind of brought in to kind of advise, I guess, on how to kind of renew or refresh their commentary in the new age. Can you kind of expand on the article and how it's been received?
Yeah, well, Jared Waitley stepped down from the ABC to join SEN in Melbourne. Obviously, he just wanted to talk more about, you know, which halfback is cheating on his girlfriend.
With Chuka from Cranbourne.
What Eddie McGuire's doing this week. It's an interesting career mood. I'd actually love to chat to him about why he did it. But anyway, so he stepped down, and when I was involved with ABC, he was very much being moved towards cricket at that time. And they brought me in to be a consultant because they knew that broadcast was, you know, ordinary. I was probably a little bit harder than ordinary, but it was a shambles. They had no one in charge. There was about seven or eight co-commentators that year. No one from full-time ABC staff through to freelancers had any idea what they were doing from a week-to-week basis. If I remember correctly, I think Drew Morfitt wasn't even supposed to be commentating, but he virtually just turned up and they put him on air. I think maybe a week before he said, "Where's my hotel booking?" And they realised none of them had told him he wasn't doing commentary. If I remember the rumours from that time correctly. So it was terribly run. They brought me in and they said, "We're going to bring Jared Waitley in and we're going to change some things." And I said, "Great, here's a list of all the things that I think you should change." And they went, "No, I don't think you heard us. We're bringing Jared Waitley in. We don't really need to do much else." And I went, no, I understand what you're saying. Here's a list of the things you should change. Here's how you make it more modern. Here's how you make it be involved with social media. Here's how you make the commentators back into... maybe household names pushing it a little bit, but the Roebuck karaoke stays. Tim Lane days, they were certainly bigger names. And I looked at all those sorts of things with them. And I spent months. I must have written 4 or 5 different reports for them. And by the end, they took about 2 or 3 of my submissions, and they decided to pretty much that Jared would fix all their problems. And Jared's a brilliant broadcaster. Whether he's a cricket person or not, he's a brilliant broadcaster, and he obviously fixed some of the errors that they had. But the problem being that Jared was never going to last. He was probably never going to do the Ashes. He was probably never going to do a World Cup if it was in footy season. You know, there's a lot of different tours that he wouldn't be able to do because he has a TV show in Melbourne that's on about 400 nights a week, from what I can tell. and, you know, he's a big deal, and he's got to get other work in Melbourne, I would assume, from being Jared lately. So the idea that he was suddenly going to put all that on hold for a sport that he hadn't shown to be his main sport up until that point seemed a really odd one. And the ABC just didn't really want to listen to it. I pushed the other ideas that I thought they could improve the broadcast with, and they eventually just went, no, I think we've got this fixed now. Just tell us that we're doing a good job. I didn't tell them that they were doing a good job, and they stopped talking to me. And really good lesson there. Always stuck up to the executive. And then this week, Jared leaves, and, you know, they're almost back where they started. Although I will say, I think they have a far better team than they had 2 years ago.
I love this conversation, Jared. I liked reading your piece as well, because it really reminded us how kind of iconic that grandstand team is. It really does have a gravitas or a gravity to it, sort of just beyond a normal radio station. It reminds us a lot of, you know, growing up. It reminds a lot of our sort of, you know, the older generation of who they listened to growing up. You've obviously been quite forthright in, you know, your views about what you think the ABC should have done back then, because I understand it was a sort of a re-released piece this week. So tell us, what should they do now? Waitley's gone. What does ABC grandstand cricket coverage need to do now? Kimber, tell us.
Mitch Marsh.
I think the first thing they need to do is they need to work out what it means to them. So they need to work out how important it is to them. There's certainly, and I think this was the case even when I was doing it, there's certainly a move among some of the executives that cricket doesn't need to be on the radio anymore. And they need to work out whether they believe it does. I think if they look into it, they'll work out it is actually part of the national fabric and there's nothing else to listen to during the summer. You know, you can only call John Fain in Melbourne so many times to talk about, you know, what the Herald Sun has written. Sorry, it's Melbourne going. But, you know, there's a certain point where having something else on is actually quite good. So I think the first thing they need to do is do that. The second is that they need to actually start building cricket specialists within the ABC. It's not like another sport. It's not like some of the smaller sports, like, say, tennis. ABC probably doesn't need a specialist tennis voice, but I think they do for cricket. And they also need to think about it strategically. But when there's big tours, when there's World Cups, and these sorts of things, they need to build someone in and they need to make some really clear decisions. So it's not just important to hire Cathitch and Rogers and Dirk Nattis. The ball by ballers end up being as important. I mean, Tim Lane is still, you know, an incredible commentator and is still really, you know, widely regarded. I mean, Jim is the one person who stayed there the whole time and is really important. Those are the sorts of people they need to build up again. And you don't get that from having Quinton Hull on 2 tests and then having Alistair Nicholson on a test and then having, you know, Peter Walsh on a test. Do you know what I mean? You need to actually start to think about it as a team itself. And I think those are the most important things. And the rest of the stuff, look, no one gives a crap about. But, it is about team branding and research and leadership and making sure that you know what you're trying to do. I mean, the biggest problem with cricket commentary worldwide is now, because of Crick Info and because of Twitter and because of, you know, Crick Buzz and these sorts of places, fans know more about the cricket than some of the commentators who are talking about it. You can't have that anymore. You can't have a commentator turn up and not know. You know, I think it was during the World Cup, someone in the BBC was like, who's this Mustafa Rahman? He seems to have taken a lot of wickets. Is he a spinner? You know, people are going to make the piss out of you now. You can't have that. So there should be research and there should be leadership. And also, and this is, I think, the most important thing, if you're putting someone on air for 7 hours a day, train them how to speak. Why do we think that someone who's done a few press conferences in their life is suddenly broadcast? I mean, for the love of God, Channel 9 have proved that inaccurate for years now. Like, you need to actually find people who can broadcast. And And Dan Brettig sent me a message after that piece went online to say that people don't think about Richie Benno, but Richie Benno actually, he's treated as this weird sort of otherworldly creature who just appeared and was incredible. No, he was a trained journalist who became a trained broadcaster. Imagine that. He actually learned the skills and then did the job really well. So, ABC should be looking at that.
So you're saying that the answer is the ABC signing Gus Warland as head of cricket commentary?
I'm going to be honest. I'm from Melbourne. I don't really know what a Gus Warland is. His name comes up.
I don't know what an SEN is. But who is SEN? Just quickly, what is this radio station that has snatched Jared Waitley from us? Like, tell us. We're from Sydney. For all the non-Melbourne listeners out there, what is SEN?
SEN. When I explain SEN. So I work for TalkSport a bit in the UK. When I explain TalkSport to people from Melbourne, I say it's like SEN, but successful. SEN is a very small radio station in Melbourne that just does, up until recently, just basically did sport talk back. And so it hires people like, we're on a cricket thing, so we'll do it. Rodney Hogg was their cricket guru for years. I think maybe Victorian cricketers might have had a late night radio show. Maybe you guys remember Nick Jewell, and you should remember Nick Jewell.
He might have
had his own show. Yeah. He was far more entertaining on the radio from what I remember than he was when he batted. But it's almost like a very small town. It's based on the American, the sort of Boston, Chicago sports radio stations. And it's basically 80% footy, and occasionally, they talk about Ben Simmons now, and then they talk about the cricket.
You got it.
And it's ex-footy players mostly that you would never have heard of, that sort of personality-driven football players end up with a show there. And, if you're from Melbourne and you're massively keen on Melbourne sports, it's not the worst thing in the world to listen to. And it's just that Jared Waitley, feels like he's a bigger name than that.
Perfect fit.
It just feels like him sort of regretting. Just when he was about to take over the world, he decided to, move to Cranbourne.
Jared, I mean, one last question about the grandstand stuff before we get onto your novella, which I want to talk about for lots of reasons because it is right in our wheelhouse. The press box that you are part of with cricket must be absolutely salivating over this this vacancy at ABC Grandstand. I mean, and you guys are, your occupational hazard is speculating over selections of players, but now we're all speculating over selections of press box people to get into the this vacant grandstand position. I mean, are you willing to speculate? I mean, what names are in there? What new names should we expect at the ABC? I mean, Collins has been on the show. You've got Gideon Haig. I mean, dare I say, Jay Kimber, who's done some time, on Grandstand before. I mean, what are we... let's talk selections. The great cricketer. What?
I think slagging off almost all the executives at the ABC probably wasn't the best way for me to get the job. although you never know.
It has worked before.
ABC get abused so much by the Australian commercial sectors. They might have seen mine as a bit of a love letter. they sent Alistair Nicholson to India, didn't they? Which I thought was an interesting move, and I think he might be doing Sydney. I wouldn't think they'd go with an outsider like Adam Collins or Jeff Lemon. They're looking for a broadcaster, and I don't want to speak for Gideon Haig, but I'm pretty sure Gideon Haig wouldn't want to do it anyway. And he certainly doesn't see himself as a broadcaster. So they're probably looking for someone like that. But realistically, I think the most important thing is maybe just not to rush it and to look at the whole team. As I said, in some ways, there's almost two spots available. Because, if you think of Jim and then you've got two other permanent ball-by bowlers. I'd like to see someone like Mel Jones on the team, and I suggested that to them at the time. I think Mel's great. Cricket knowledge is incredible, and she's very professional. Alison Mitchell is probably another potential as well. She now splits her time between England and Australia. So there's a lot of people out there, but I would assume, being the ABC, they will probably go with someone from within. So Nicholson is maybe the best choice, or their obvious choice, I should say.
Or Mick Molloy. No, that's very giving of you. Jared, to give us an insight into Grandstand. I'm sure people find that fascinating. I want to talk. Let's talk about your novella. And I'm saying novella. It feels good to say. Like, a novella is obviously a smaller version of a novel. You've released this in December. It's called The Lily of Campbellfield, an autobiographical piece on the relationship with your relationship with your father in Melbourne's outer suburbs. A story about two different men, cricket, school, suicide, work, true crime. And this recurring kind of motif throughout it, I read this yesterday, about a fire in your gut. You know, tell us broadly about this novella. It's about you and your dad, really.
Yeah, I wanted to write something about him because he had such a big impact on, I suppose, who I am today, like just in a father point of view, but also, you know, as I've pointed out in other podcasts before, my mother's a librarian and my dad was a cricket coach and I became a cricket writer. It's not, you know, I didn't go that far from where the two of them
adopted.
Really. And my dad, you know, my dad's quite he's a good drinker, but he's a bit of a quiet guy and he doesn't talk much. And, you know, he was a bit of a, you know, local cricket legend back in the day. He wasn't the same as Clint McKay's dad. Clint McKay's dad was properly famous in the same league. Right. My dad was a couple of levels below that. But there was certainly, you know, sort of thing where I was known as PK's son and he'd be taking absolute shitloads of wickets. I mean, he took, I don't know, 1-9 for 2-8 and probably 25-37 in club cricket career. And he's the sort of guy that bowled, you know, he would bowl like 25-35 over spells, despite the fact that he wasn't always the slimmest man. I don't know, there was something about it. It was such a big part of him playing cricket was such a big part of my childhood, and then he became my coach as well. So the two things sort of came together, and I just wanted to try and talk about it a little bit. Mm. And then when I started writing about his cricket career, it sort of just bled into my life, if that makes sense. Mm. So I don't know. I wasn't meant to be autobiographical about myself. Mm. It was supposed to be about him. And then, I don't know, maybe I just found talking about his exploits too boring, so I just moved on to myself.
No, mate, it's a great... It's like, I got it yesterday. You can get it on Kindle. It's literally, I read it over lunch in an hour and a half. It's really gritty. It's totally in your kind of like, you know, like brutal, hard-hitting style. Very funny. There's a good. I mean, can you just tell me quickly? Like, you know, what is it about our obsession with our dads and cricket? Like, what is it about intergenerational relationships and men and cricket? Like, why is this so fascinating? Because we're obsessed with it.
We're obsessed with it.
Yeah, obviously you guys are as well. And it's a very interesting thing. My wife was born into a Sri Lankan Muslim family in Essex, and she. Her father was a little disappointed. He kept having girls, and she actually really got into cricket. And he just wouldn't have anything to do with it until Sachin Tendulkar came along and was playing in English summer. And then he realised that she was really good for information about cricket. So it's interesting how often this happens, and it seems to be a sport almost like, you know, no other in that it brings in. Like it is a real hereditary sport, cricket. I have no idea why that is, but. My dad just wasn't very good at talking. He just, you know, he's okay over a beer, you know, but he came home from work and he was angry with his job and he got kicked out of school, so he didn't have the sort of jobs that he wanted. Very working class background. He came from Broadmeadow, so, you know, that sort of the northwest is sort of like, you know, Melbourne's west in many, sorry, Sydney's west in many ways. And, you know, he was from that kind of background and he didn't know how to talk, but, you know, through cricket, I could hang out with him and we could build a relationship. And, you know, there was something there. And it also, like, you know, he didn't achieve a lot outside of family in his life. Obviously, as far as family goes, he achieved incredibly. But as far as work goes and sort of private things, he didn't achieve a lot. The one thing that he was known for was, you know, bowling a cricket ball and swinging it around corners and taking all these wickets. So... it probably gave me something to think of him as a sort of a hero figure, which I may not have had otherwise. And I saw other relationships that fathers and sons had in a similar area to me, and the sons who went on to, you know, you know, become, I don't want to say successful because some of them are accountants, but, you know, who went on to have acceptable jobs and, you know, get buy nice houses. They would look down on their father, and I didn't have that. And I was quite interested in why that was, and I suppose that's where it came from, this weird sort of thing. And for my dad, he was a fast bowler, and so everyone thought he was stupid his whole life because of that. And when he became a coach, it allowed him to sort of, you know, grow as a person a little bit. He had to actually learn how to communicate, and he did that really well with all the other kids. And with me, he just came in and bowled me out, which was a bit of a pain in the ass.
I was going to say, Jared, as a final one, it is a great scene in the novella where you're talking about those moments at training when he was coaching you as part of the team where you would go into bat, and your dad was quite keen on you sort of playing straight and having at least a defensive framework to the way you batted, which, you know, you clearly rebelled against. You sounded like a difficult child, I'll be honest, but you're also that in the book. Can you just sort of run us through what would just that scene where you would come into bat in the nets and your dad was coach?
Yeah, well, we, it was quite a poor working class club out near Broadmeadows. And so it's not like we had a lot of good cricket balls. So, you know, and we were under 14s and under 16s. So we got whatever the seniors didn't want, mostly. He still had the ability at well into his 40s, mid-40s, to pick up the cricket ball when I was slogging and just come in into the rotation, just gesture to everyone else. You know the gesture, you've seen it from the old man who said, "Settle down, lads, I'm going to bowl to him now." And the minute he came into bowl, I knew he had my number. I knew he knew exactly where to bowl and I would miss it.
I'll never go to training.
Davey's wincing.
To be fair. Sorry?
Sorry,
Just go, visibly wincing at the thought of dad bowling to me at training in front of all my mates, just the fear of getting out to him, not being able to live that down, would go on for decades.
And it was always after I'd hit a really good shot. Like, it was always after I'd lost the opening bowler or slogged the spinner, and that was when he did it. Because I can pick this ball up, and it's going to go through you. And he did it every time. At the very best I could ever do would be a limp defensive shot where the ball would be rolling at my feet and I'd have to kick it away. That was the best I ever got out of it. If I tried to drive it on the up, it was nicking off. And if I tried to defend or actually slog it, I just got bowled. So it was horrible. The whole thing was horrible. But, you know, there was a certain thing between the two of us that we came from the same world, but we came from different worlds. And that was his way of going, you know, you still have to actually not be a dickhead, I think. He never ever said to me, "Don't be a dickhead." He just said it through swing bowling.
No words, just outswingers.
I can't recommend the novella enough. It's called The Lily of Campbellfield. You can get it on Kindle. You can get it basically through the internet. That's what we're talking about, aren't we, Jared? Yes.
I got a very funny story about it today, actually. Yeah. So you guys are getting this hot off the presses. My old man actually took me to the airport today when I was coming up to Sydney. And we pulled in, and there was a guy in front of us who was being a bit erratic on the road. My old man was getting a bit upset. And it turned out that was a taxi driver. And the person in front of us that he was dropping off was Dennis Lilley. And I said to my old man, "Look, come out, we'll chat to him." And my old man's like, "Nah. Couldn't do that," and just got back in the car and drove off. So we had a chance of actually the real Dennis Lilley and the Lily of Camberfield meeting a mile down.
It sounds like a second edition chapter, maybe to insert towards the end of the novella.
Exactly.
Jared, thanks so much for joining us, mate, the great cricketer. It's a vivid, vivid read, right in the style of the way you talk, mate. And thanks for illuminating us on the state of play at ABC Grandstand as well. I'm sure we'll all be watching it very closely.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on, guys.
We great cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
wonderful to have Jared Kimber on the show. We should just point out at this point of time that Dave and I, Sam obviously is not coming over for the UK for this test match, but Dave and I will be at the SCG, given that's where we live, and we've been very kindly given press passes again. So we're going to be knocking about in the members and just trying to grab as many people as possible who will talk to us, and releasing little snippets of podcasts throughout the week over the next 5-6 days or so. So stay tuned for that. And then, of course, the podcast will resume as ever in your ears on Thursday, the longer form one. But hopefully we get to speak to some really cool people again. So that's what's going to be happening on the Grey Cricketer podcast for the next few days or so. Pez.
Why just the members, can I ask? Is that... You just don't knock outside the members.
We do have passes for the full ground, he goes, but is there anything else?
You can go anywhere.
Yeah. You can go anywhere. All right. Hashtag RTDC. That's elitist and unnecessary. Of course, we're happy to see anyone as long as you are wearing a collared shirt. All right. Blake Fisher has said, hey, guys, don't have Twitter, so he slid into the old Facebook DMs using the hashtag AskTJC. Can I please get the correct salad to rig ratio for successful chopping? I'm the recently re-elected mayor of Rig City, but Nathan Lyon has more salad than me on a good day. Do I give up the gym and pipes for an Ashley and Martin program or a visit to Greg Matthews? Thanks, lads. Love the podcast. I don't know who want to ask this one first, but Blake wants to know what the correct rig to ratio is for successful chopping, but he has also called himself the recently re-elected mayor of Rig City. Who wants to take this one?
I suppose I can kick off with some experience. Ashley and Martin is very expensive, I didn't do it, but I asked.
Did you call up for a free consult?
The ad definitely spoke to me many, many times, but I went into Ashley and Martin and the guy like put I had hair at the time, and he put a mirror over my head and said, "See, look, it's a horseshoe."
Our team of doctors.
I'll never forget that. Age 22. Just like the Kings of Leon song, 18, balding. See, it's a horseshoe. And now it was the guy from the ad.
Oh, that's the name of the show.
Can't watch Melbourne Cup anymore.
That's the name of the show.
I see you say that ad and the guy's like, oh, I had bad hair too. It's like, no, you didn't, mate. You have fucking great hair and you're an actor. But the guy wants... So back to Blake's question. He wants an actual ratio. Like, how did that be expressed numerically? Salad
Hang
to
on
rig.
A second.
Like,
hang on a second.
3 to 4.
I mean, Pezza, I really have enjoyed that you've spoken to your own insecurities about this, because the listeners will love that. But he's just called himself the recently re-elected mayor of Rig City. Is no one's going to take that on?
Yeah.
No one's.
You won't
no
let this go, will you? Here goes.
Well, what the fuck is that?
Well, it's obviously a self-appointed role, because that doesn't sound democratic to me at all. He's just re-elected himself.
Re-elected
in his own head.
As well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He lost
his
post.
How long are the terms? Like 4 years?
Re-elected?
3 years? Yeah, but Bez, you're right. Like,
how were the elections run?
Rigged. Russian. Russia was involved.
Yeah.
How do we, you're right, like, how do we actually, even when we figure out which one is more important, how do we express it? Is it like a 1-3 ratio? Like, because he's obviously leaning towards rig.
Mm-hmm.
3-1 rig?
Yeah.
Well, I think you can...
And Rig City, but presumes that there's a city of rigs. Mm. So he's the mayor of that.
Sounds like it's on the Gold Coast.
Sorry.
I don't like this question anymore. I'm going to move on from it. Sorry, Blake. Please. I don't know what the correct answer is, but all I'll say is you can have great salad and a shit rig, but you'll be more of a chop king if you have no salad and a great rig. Look at Bruce Willis. I'm trying to think of like other bald. I'm moving
Statham.
On from this. Jason Statham. It's exactly who I was thinking of. All right.
Vin Diesel.
Jack Hudson says, holy shit, boys, the Grey Cricketer is likely the most I have ever laughed during a book. You lot are bloody nuts. In 1 month, I'm coming down to Australia to play cricket for the first time as a 19-year-old, and now I'm scared shitless that people will be champing me and saying yuck in regard to my rig. I'm now spending overtime brushing up on my movie quotes and clearly need to up my chop stories to avoid being Alfred. Thanks for the advice on the chub up as well. I certainly did not expect that in the book. I will know what to do when we first hit the showers. However, the promise of the Triple C, the circuit, and stepping up my game and adopting to your insane culture of cricket has me encouraged. I know I can do it. I'm ready for the sledging. Bring on the throwdowns. Lab on the Vincent character. You! Here's an answer question.
Very, very upbeat just statement, isn't it? Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen such an upbeat reader question or an RTGC correspondence. I'm pretty excited that he's used the Latin phrase labor omnia vincit, which is loosely translated means work fucking hard. Dedicated listeners will recall that from the first book. Jack, just let us know how you go down under. I'm interested to hear how you go and how long you last before taking up golf.
And also buy the second book. To that end, Sam Badalato says, finish reading your book in half a day. I hate reading, but fuck, I kept going. Again, not a question. Just like, I mean, like, to a lot of, like, that's our audience.
Not even a full
fuck,
stop
I,
there.
I hate reading, but fuck, I kept going.
Yeah, not with the sentence, though.
Yeah. Great of you to persist with it.
Yeah.
All right, McConthy Teve says, dear RTGC, that doesn't make sense. During a first date, a blind one, mind you, my date mentioned that she grew up listening to cricket as her sounds of summer childhood memory. I married that woman 15 years on, and she has not watched even an over of cricket with me. Is this grounds? Please advise.
Yeah, you were lied to, McConthy Teve. That's pretty much the straight answer there, isn't it? You've spoken about cricket on the blind date, and she's made an effort to impress you and said it was the sound of summer for me growing up. And then once you've sort of started going out with her, she said absolutely no chance. It's a terrible game.
But to be fair, Pez, she's only listed this as a childhood memory. It's not a treasured memory. Like my fiance is similar in that she grew up with brothers and the cricket was always on, but she doesn't really have any interest in cricket whatsoever, although she did provide the artwork for the first book, for which I'm forever indebted to her. But I don't think she's misled him in any way here. Yeah, I don't think she's been misled. I mean, I think we all tell white lies on first dates. You don't think that content's going to come back at you.
Yeah,
because
that's
you probably
point.
Know more about this than us.
Well, that's a good point. It's like when someone asks you, "Are you seeing other people?" and you say no.
Yeah, just a
yes
knee-jerk response. It's just a straight lie.
Always lie. I mean, that's you know, in a lot of ways, that's actually a hallmark of a true cricketer is lying, because as we've spoken many parts, many times in the past, lying is everything in cricket. So McConthy Teve, is it grounds? Yes. this one slid into Edo's DMs for some reason, and not through Ask TGC, but it is a wonderful question, so I'm going to go with it. It's David Mearsy Mears, and he asks, hey lads, thanks for the podcast. That's nice. I'm a long-time listener, first-time questioner. As a 34-year-old bloke, I've recently been questioning my decision to retire from cricket at the ripe old age of 28 when I was asked to attend my local team's pre-season nets here in the UK. Early retirement came for me, not because of an injury or a career move or even a lack of love for the game. It came after the opening league game of the season when I got 5 off 20-odd balls as an opening bat, eventually chipping one to mid-off against a 50-year-old military medium father of 4 and soon-to-be grandfather. I couldn't get him off the square. So what, you might think? You're an opening bat. You're supposed to see off the mediums and get overs into their veiny legs so the middle order can come in against the other mediums. The main challenge for me came because the week before, in the last game of the pre-season friendlies, I got 117 not out and carried my bat in a low-scoring game in April in the UK. It was against our local rivals, and the innings had it all. Cover drives, on drives, fours and sixes, including one over the scoreboard into the houses adjacent to the ground. I was in the form of my life. The next high score was 20-odd. My dad was there, so was my dad's best mate, and so was my wife, and to top it all off, we lost the match. So much. So from such pre-season highs to league lows in 6 days, I took the initiative to hang up the bat when my wife asked me, "Did you get 100 again today?" Me, "No, love. It was a tough day. It was tough out there today." Wife, "Why are you in a bad mood? You got 100 last week. Just do that again next week." I then put everything into my job that week, so the boss would take me on his next business development trip to the US, which would mean missing out on the next league game. He took me on the trip. I never played again, knowing that my batting was never going to get any better than that glorious day in April. Now I am 34, have two girls aged 5 and 3, and have started to show an interest in the game. I have the option of getting into it again with a different club, importantly, who run a cult section. Do I get the pads out of the loft, which coincidentally I never got rid of, despite vowing never to play again, and get into pre-season with a new club, knowing that me playing again will inevitably pique the interest of my girls to get into the game I love, with the other kids who come to watch their dads play every weekend? Or do I stay retired and continue to dine off 117 not out I scored in my last game? I obviously lie and tell people that about the fact that my last game was a league game where I couldn't get the ball off the square, and the 117 was actually a pre-season warm-up. I have a shit rig now, and I own my own business, so I don't have any excuse to get out of the league campaign mid-season when the wheels inevitably come off, and I think I prefer that my girls got into ballet or something and leave cricket alone for me. Thoughts, please, gents.
I love that most of these stories are going along quite nicely, and then it just gets really serious at the end, like when he's trying to hurry it up. I have a shit rig, I own business, I'm not sure what I want my daughters to get into. Like, it's really breathless.
I have a shit rig now and I own my own business.
I think dine. He's got to dine. Dine out in the 117. Don't get your kids into cricket. I like the idea that, like, there's some leap response between, like as if kids 5 and 3 would like watching their dad playing cricket.
No, you're 34 and you've got a shit rig now, and you've run your own business, which means you probably should be spending time on that business, because I'm not sure how long you've been running it, but you know, the first year 50% of businesses go under, so you probably should pour all your resources into that. The bit that I found funny was that during this 117 not out, he talked about how his dad was there, but his dad's best mate was there as well.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely, Eddos. I tend to think that, like, yeah, I think the closer his kids get to cricket, the closer they are to the lie. Do you know what I mean? So I think that, like, if they suddenly get into cricket, then they discover, you know, online portals such as My Cricket and Play Cricket, which is the equivalent in the UK, you know, they'll discover that he actually played one more league game after he's 117, and they'll realise that their dad is actually a horrible, horrible failure.
Well, this was 6 years ago because he retired at 28. So, yeah, there definitely would have been some online portals around that could...
Yeah, Play Cricket, definitely.
Yeah, quite categorically show that he failed in his last actual game, 5 off 20-odd balls as an opening bat.
He couldn't get up the square. So I think what we're saying is stay away from cricket, get the girls into ballet or something, even though, you know, cricket is a wonderful sport for young kids, both sexes. But I think, like, for his sake, for David's sake, Mirzy's sake, he needs to protect the lie and live as a hero forever.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay. It's been a wonderful show. Thank you, as ever, to Sam Perry, David Edwards. My name's Ian Higgins. Jared Kimber, a wonderful, wonderful guest. The final test match of the Australian summer is starting today. Look forward to you joining us next week.